Good morning. I'm delighted to welcome you all to a show-off day. We're going to show our stuff today. And let me begin with some general overview remarks. I have a lot more gray hair than just about anybody else in this room. And it's a way of saying as I look back on my professional life, I've lived through three major breakpoints in history. It's true I was just a little kid when World War II began, but I do have pretty clear memories of, even in my preteen years, of some of the atmospherics of World War II. Then, of course, the Cold War, and then we're here to talk about events since 9/11. The reason I mention these breakpoints is very relevant to what we're here to talk about today. And just looking back over this history, what was truly remarkable about the onset of World War II is that virtually overnight, this country shifted gears and went from an isolationist mode to full industrialization, building up our military in preparation for what you might call conventional warfare in Europe and then later in the Pacific in a truly remarkable way. I mean, there was almost not skipping a beat in that transition. And that experience is in sharp contrast to the Cold War transition. And that was one I was very much involved in terms of my professional training. I mean, some of the events that are stuck in my mind were Khrushchev banging his shoe on the table at the United Nations. And when I was in graduate school, many of my faculty teachers were involved in advising the Kennedy administration at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis on how to deal with that situation. We were all ready to go out to Western Massachusetts and dig bomb shelters. But what's significant is that it took almost a decade and a half for this country to figure out exactly how to deal with the Cold War. If you take its beginnings in 1947-48 through the Cuban Missile Crisis and then on. And my professional training was derivative of that in the sense that the country invested over a decade. The Ford Foundation, the National Defense Education Act, put a lot of money into training Soviet specialists. My training was in Chinese affairs. So we created a generation of talent that, less or more, that helped to manage our dealings with various countries and cope with the challenges of the Cold War period. And I'm afraid we're in a situation now that is very much like the World War II, the Cold War experience, not the World War II experience. I think we are thrashing around trying as a country to come up with the key elements of a foreign policy posture, a national security posture, a way of dealing with the world that includes at least four key elements. One is to understand the challenge. Secondly is to derive policies that are appropriate to the challenge that we face. Third is institutional reform that gives embodiment and application of those policies. And again, I don't need to go into detail, but here we are struggling to adapt our intelligence community. The military now for almost a decade has been trying to restructure itself to deal with a post-Cold War world. All of the efforts right now to deal with the questions of how do you deal with detainees, how is our judicial system to cope with a very different kind of threat. These are all the elements of trying to create policies and institutions to deal with this new situation. And a fourth major element is the training of skilled people who have the understanding to implement the policies, work within the institutions, and hopefully cope with the challenges of this very new world that fell in upon us in after 9/11. It's a tragedy, but we did not make the investment in training people in Arabic language, just as one example. Area studies, if you go to many universities, political science departments today, foreign area studies are not in regard. The so-called rational choice people, the rat choices, dominate political science faculties. There aren't jobs available for foreign area specialists in the way that when I was being trained, I was lucky there were. I had several job offers just because there weren't many people trained in Chinese politics. So we are in a period that, as I say, is going to go on for quite some time before we've created this framework to deal with the world post 9/11. And that is one of the things that this institution is fully committed to. Let me just say that the focus could be, and in some quarters is a matter of discussion, because the challenge of the Muslim world, and we'll talk about, you know, is there a Muslim world and what does that mean as the day unwinds, but that is only one element of really fundamental changes that are occurring in our world, and the other relates to my area of specialization, and that is China. That there is a fundamental transformation in the global economy related to the rise of China, the rise of India, and that's a big ball out there that we've taken our eye off of, as well as other issues that people will tell you we should be focusing on. That is not the China rise, the transformation of the global economy is not a set of issues that is on the focal point of the charter and the concerns of the Institute of Peace might well be. I could just say personally that the China today that I look at, I'm really not competent to deal with. I was trained for the Mao era. You really got to know economics. You've got to go live in a Chinese village and do things that in my training years I was never able to do. So that, even though Paul Stairs and I talk about looking at China-related issues, it's really not the center, certainly, of our work. And I can tell you that the cadre of China specialists, as with the Russia-Soviet specialists, has not been recreated. There isn't a very large pool of talent there, as is also the case now with those competent to understand the Muslim world. But it's in this context that we're delighted that you're here today to let us show you, share with you the work of what we call our Muslim World Initiative, directed by Abdeslam Magraoui, who came to us from Princeton University. We've handed out material that will give you his background and the background of all the other speakers who represent the really remarkable talent that the Institute has available for working on the range of issues that you'll hear about today. The three cross-cutting themes that Abdeslam and his colleagues have developed to organize our work of this major initiative of the Institute of Peace. Three cross-cutting themes, if you like. First is, since there is a clear security threat to this new situation, how do we deal with the political violence? And the theme that we use, we refer to as finding ways to marginalize the militants. And again, you'll be hearing some path-breaking work that Paul has been doing on that theme. But related to it is, how do we mobilize the moderates? How do we gain the support of those voices, those sources of authority and leadership in the Muslim world who do not see the use of violence as the basis for pressing their interests, their sense of challenge with the non-Muslim world. And here again, you're going to hear some really important work that David Smock and many others have been working on that theme. And just coming in, we have a table that's out there groaning with publications that reflect the work that we've been doing on that theme. The third theme is what we refer to as bridging the divide. And here I just might note that Abdeslam has put together a U.S. Muslim World Advisory Committee of American Muslims who are a sounding board for interpreting events both here and abroad that are relevant to this initiative. It's a group that has had very senior access. They have had a meeting with Secretary of State Rice, with Karen Hughes on several occasions, and this advisory group I think has made a real contribution and will continue to do so. So that is sort of a broad way of saying that as we take our very broad charter from Congress to find ways of dealing with the world that stress nonviolent, peaceful approaches to managing conflict, we consider our Muslim World Initiative to be a centerpiece of our efforts, as reflected in the projects, the activities that you'll hear about today. So again, thanks very much for being with us. And now, Abdeslam, I'm delighted to turn the podium to you.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. Good morning and welcome. Since September 11th, we have seen four critical trends developing in the Muslim world. Although these trends have been simmering for decades, recent events have given them immediacy and global importance. The first is obviously increasing ideological extremism and terrorism in the Muslim world. Despite operational successes against terrorist networks, radicalization seems to be spreading among diverse social strata and to different parts of the Muslim world. The process of radicalization has begun at least since the 1970s. However, events of the past 5 years have given or are giving recruiters energy and are motivating supporters. A second development that is noteworthy in the Muslim world is related to the U.S. official endorsement of democratic change in the Muslim world. We have seen both a proliferation of government and civil society democracy initiatives, but also a backlash against the promotion of democracy in the region. Recently, the United States and the West in general have come to the conclusion that the absence of political rights, the absence of economic opportunity, are feeding frustrations, extremism, and radicalization. But these democratic or democratization efforts have not had significant impact due to three factors. One is the continuing dependence of the United States on authoritarian regimes to counter terrorism. The second is the weakness of the secular democratic opposition in the Muslim world. And the third is the ambiguous commitment of the Islamist political parties to democratic norms. So as a result, non-democratic governments in Muslim-majority countries still endures. The endurance of authoritarian regimes in the Muslim world, especially in the Middle East and North Africa part, has a negative impact on U.S. overall strategy in the region and interests. It complicates plans to confront the threat of terrorism. It undermines efforts to conclude badly needed peaceful settlements in the region, and it prevents the development of regional security arrangement in the Middle East. The third important development that I see in the Muslim world is the widespread anti-American, anti-Western sentiments among many Muslims. After World War II, the United States had a positive image in the Muslim world. This was mainly due to American support for the principle of self-determination, to important aid programs and educational programs in the Muslim world, and to America's own cultural and religious diversity. This has changed, but growing anti-American and anti-Western attitudes in the Muslim world were dismissed for a moment as inconsequential. During the past 5 years, however, it has become clear that anti-American sentiment can represent a serious hurdle to implementing policies and meaningful change in the region. It is indeed hard to imagine a decisive victory against extremism and terrorism, meaningful democratization, or the peaceful settlement of pivotal conflicts if the United States is feared and resented. A final important development in the Muslim world is the growing perception among ordinary citizens as well as government officials that U.S. leadership is perhaps compromised at this point. U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and possibly the rest of the Muslim world is facing the biggest crisis in recent decades. The challenges in Iraq and Iran, uncertainties in Lebanon and Afghanistan, the deadlock of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and the perception of inaction in Sudan and Somalia. All of these are testing America's commitment and capacity to continue to be a major player in the region. So without a comprehensive strategy that addresses these trends, challenges, and conflicts, the U.S. has little chance of marginalizing extremists, empowering the moderates, bridging the divide, and playing a broken role in peace settlements. So with the keen awareness of the need to see the big picture, we have put together a sequence of panels that will highlight the connection between the most important challenges and opportunities facing the United States today in the Muslim world. On each panel, colleagues from the U.S. Institute of Peace will present their recent work. Each panelist will have about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open the floor to questions and answers. This morning, we'll begin with two panels. One, countering extremism and terrorism, and the other on reforming the Muslim world. We'll break for lunch around 12:15, and we'll resume for two more panels at 1:15. And we will conclude the meetings today at 4 o'clock. So without further delay, I invite my colleague Ted Pfeiffer to begin the panel.
Good morning. I'm Ted Pfeiffer from the Institute's training program. I'd like to introduce you to Paul Stairs, Vice President for the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, who will make the lead presentation, and he will be followed by Christine Fair, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention of the Institute, who will follow.
Okay. Thanks, Ted. Good morning to you all, and thank you all for being here today. I want to share with you some of the work that we've been doing at the Institute over the last couple of years in the area of how to meet the challenge of terrorism in the wake of 9/11. I think it's fair to say, and this work's been done by myself, Christine Fair, and Mona Yacoubian, who I think is in the audience, as well as others here. I think it's fair to say this work has been driven by three interlocking frustrations about how we have prosecuted the so-called war on terrorism since 9/11. The first of these is, I think, the sense that there is still no clarity or broad consensus about the nature of the threat we face. We're still trying to grasp the nature of the new strategic challenge we face and how best to counter it. And I think this is best reflected in the fact we still don't have any broad consensus on what to call this challenge. We all knew right after 9/11 that the attacks were perpetrated by Al-Qaeda, but for a variety of reasons, some of them defensible, we chose to focus on the threat being terrorism writ large. This, we've now sort of swung from that broad extreme to another broad extreme, which has been reflected in some of the recent comments by the president in calling this threat Islamo-fascism, which I think also has similar problems associated with it. In fact, the recent visit of Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey highlighted some of his concerns with that term. Now, this is not just a question of semantics. Labels and terms have real operational import. It actually drives policy, it drives strategy. So we have to have a clear consensus on the nature of the threat. The second frustration we face, I think, is that there is still no comprehensive conception of how this challenge works, if you will, and the inherent dynamism of it. We typically, when we face complex phenomena, we tend to deconstruct it, to disaggregate elements of it into areas which we're most familiar. So the tendency has been to focus on the leadership and the organizations associated with the challenge, to focus on that rather than the underlying ideology or the factors propelling this phenomenon. And as a consequence, we have a sort of disaggregated conception of the threat, which also has, I think, damaging effects on policy. And thirdly, we have no, I think, real clear long-term strategy for dealing with this threat. I think the imperative to respond to the threats, to the attacks, 9/11, to invade Iraq, I think overrode a long-term game plan. And as a result, we have had, since then, I think, a mishmash of a number of initiatives in the area of military initiatives, traditional counterterrorism efforts, diplomatic efforts to prohibit terrorism at the UN, hearts and minds activities, as well as public diplomacy and war of ideas, and of course the so-called Big Bang transformative policies in the Middle East. Consequently, many of these policies have worked at cross purposes to one another. There's really no priority associated with any one of these initiatives, and certainly many of them suffer from being unbalanced in terms of the resources devoted to them. Let me turn now to how we have responded to these three central critiques of the war on terrorism. Firstly, in terms of defining a new strategic challenge, our preference is to classify the challenge as Islamist militancy. Like the 9/11 Commission, we employ the modifier Islamist instead of Islamic, underscoring the political, religious nature of the movement within the Muslim world rather than Islamic, which is the religion, the culture of Islam. Unlike the 9/11 Commission, however, we prefer to use the simpler, less loaded term of militancy rather than terrorism. We all know how difficult it is to define terrorism. And we also feel that militancy encompasses not only those who actually carry out terrorist acts or militant acts, but also those who espouse it. And we think that they are just as important in propelling this phenomenon. Now, this is not a monolithic movement. And again, that is another, I think, deficiency in the way we look at this challenge. There are clearly the so-called transnational jihadist organizations, with al-Qaeda being the preeminent one, with a global agenda, or at least broad regional agendas. There are secondly the more focused ethno-nationalist insurgent groups in specific areas of the world, Hamas, Hezbollah, some of the Kashmiri groups, and elsewhere. And thirdly, there are the myriad groups and networks that help propel this, give it legitimacy, directly support it, indirectly support it. So they're the sort of the three component elements in broad terms for Islamist militancy. Now, let me turn now to the second brief criticism. How should we think about this challenge posed by Islamist militancy? It's clearly not a traditional national security threat. We invoke the Cold War as a guiding inspiration to how we should deal with this. I think there are some comparisons, but I think we should not push those comparisons too far. Neither is it a traditional terrorist threat. And again, while some traditional counter-terrorist methods have relevance here, we should not conflate the two. Nor is it a global insurgency, which I think a lot of people like to characterize it as. I think this, in some respects, gives validity to the jihadist message. It tends to conflate the threat, and I think it also privileges military countermeasures in response. Now, so how should we, what is our suggestion of how we should think about this threat? And I think we were inspired, or at least interested, by the fact that in listening to the debate, many people were using metaphors from the epidemiological world. They were looking at disease metaphors, talking about this being a kind of virus, the virulent ideology of bin Laden, the problem was metastasizing. John Negroponte, just a week or so ago, talked about the problem mutating. And we were drawn to the fact that this seemed to have some intuitive appeal. And so we became interested in a burgeoning part of political science literature, looking at the growth of social, what they call social contagion theories, how ideas and fads and fashions spread. And so we tried to deconstruct the challenge using this method, epidemiological prism. And I think the more we looked at this, the more we became intrigued by the comparisons. Not that terrorism or Islamist militancy is a natural disease, but that as a methodological framework for capturing the different elements of the threat and trying to understand how it's spreading, that it has some real utility. Let me try to explain in greater detail. Now, epidemiologists employ a standard approach to study epidemics that deconstructs the outbreak of any disease into four key components. They talk about the agent, which is the pathogen or bacterium that spreads the disease, that actually is the disease. They talk about the host, those who are actually the carriers of the disease, the environment, the factors that shape the spread of the disease and possibly lead to its outbreak in specific areas, as well as, crucially, the key vectors that help propagate and spread the disease. And all these interact in a dynamic way. Now, if we use that model in the context of Islamist militancy, the agent in this sense is the Islamist militant ideology, and again, it's not a unified ideology. There are strains within this ideology. The host is the personal group who has adopted the ideology and is driven by it and motivated by it. The terrorist organizations, the cells, the individuals. The environment refers to the key factors in the Muslim world that promote the exposure of Islamist militancy to people, as well as lead to its rise in key areas: conflict, political repression, economic stagnation, social alienation, and other factors. And the vectors are the variety of conduits used to propagate the ideology, from mosques to prisons to madrasas, the internet, satellite TV, and these are critical elements in the spread of the ideology. Now, using this basic approach to the study or to the conceptualization of the challenge, we've devised a new strategy for dealing with it. And again, it takes inspiration from how public health officials confront any outbreak of an infectious disease. And there are three key elements. It's the CPR approach. First, to contain the most threatening outbreaks of a disease, to prevent it from gaining enough mass and momentum to overwhelm public health officials and public security officials. Standard methods include quarantine, treatment, rehabilitation. The second is to protect those who are most susceptible to the disease, the high-risk groups that are clearly most exposed and most vulnerable to the disease, as well as the high-value groups that you rely on to help defend against it. And here, the most effective countermeasure is targeted immunization programs. The third component of a classic counter-epidemic strategy is to remedy the environmental factors. They are primarily longer-term in nature. But what are the conditions that have fostered the development and spread of the disease? And here, there are many types of interventions, from local to regional to global. Now, a global counterterrorism campaign inspired by classic counter-epidemic measures would simultaneously seek to contain the spread of Islamist militancy, to protect those that are most susceptible, and remedy the key environmental factors that foster it in the Muslim world. what we have tried to do is adapt these basic principles to a broad strategy. Firstly, containing and contracting the activities of the most virulent Islamist militant organizations. That means focusing on Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, particularly those with a global reach and apocalyptic agendas, and those that are most threatening in terms of their potential to use weapons of mass destruction. Secondly, protecting the so-called high-risk and high-value communities in the Muslim world. The high-risk ones, I think, without pointing at particular communities, are those that seem to provide a disproportionate share of the jihadist fighters in this war. There are key countries that seem to be most at risk at this, as well as European diaspora groups, communities that are particularly at risk. And thirdly, looking at the high-value communities within those the high-value communities within those countries, the educational, religious, mass media, security sectors of those communities. They're the ones that we have to empower, embolden, and protect. Thirdly, it's remedying the key environmental factors. And here, it's obviously focusing on the key conflicts in the Muslim world that provide legitimacy to the jihadist narrative, Israel-Palestine being preeminent among them. Iraq, as we all know, I think, has become a rallying cry for many jihadists, but others, Chechnya, Kashmir, and elsewhere. And these help validate the central jihadist argument that Islam is under attack by the West. I can get into more detailed description of how you translate these broad programmatic goals and objectives into specific programs in the discussion. I'd be happy to, but I'm getting the hook here. So, the combined effect of you cannot look at these individually. It has to be an integrated, comprehensive game plan in which these are all mutually reinforcing, and I think we have to accept, as the public health officials do, that there is no quick, easy cure to this malady. It's something that requires extended commitment from a broad range of actors if we are to be successful. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Paul. And I hope during the question period you'll press Paul for lots of specifics and particular conflict areas on the application of the concepts. Christine?
I'm going to talk a little bit about the purported linkages between Pakistan's religious seminaries, the so-called Dini Madaris, or Madaris for short, and militancy. Since about 2000, and particularly after 9/11, both the scholarly literature and the popular press have been rife with characterizations of Madaris. Some of my favorites include institutions of mass instruction, pipelines for militants, in language of this sort. I think two of the most important studies in this narrative are, of course, the writings of Jessica Stern and the International Crisis Group. Now, those studies have tended to dilate upon the numbers of students, the numbers of madrasas, and then, of course, tying this to the very obvious presence of a wide array of different kinds of militants in Pakistan. Now, unfortunately, those very early studies, and some of them are actually not so early, haven't really endured the scrutiny of empiricism. So, for example, some of the crazy numbers that we all remember, the millions of madrasa students, the 100,000 madaris, really haven't been borne out by rigorous studies of, say, the Pakistani census, the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey. And part of the problem with those early studies is they relied upon interview data to collect data that really can't be collected through interviews. So let me give you an example. Using the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey, both the World Bank as well as the Pakistani think tank came up with the figure that less than 1% of all students attend madrasas full-time. Now, that's a far cry from the 33% that we got from the International Crisis Group, and there's a really good reason for it. In the ICG report, they just messed up their numerator. So when they took the number of students in madrasas and divided by the total number of all enrolled students, that denominator was 1.9 million in the ICG report, and it should have been 19 million. So, all those folks were hauled in front of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, and a lot of hoopla and a lot of interventionist policymaking was whipped up on the basis of some really spurious data. Going back to Paul's point, you know, this talk is really going to be about, to get the analysis right and to get the policy right, we have to have the data right. And so this is a talk about data. Now, at the same time, so were the student profiles wrong. We've all been told that these are students who are poor, they have no options. Well, guess what? The analysis doesn't support that either. More than 12% of these madrasa students come from the richest families in Pakistan. And about a third or so come from solidly middle-class families, of course, norming by Pakistani income standards. Now, this idea that they go to madrasas because they have no other options, that's not borne out by scrutiny either. In fact, when you're looking at localities without a non-madrasa school, families are more likely to just shift out of the educational market altogether. So while we have this narrative of scholarship that sort of depicts madrasas as the pipeline for militancy, at the same time, in fact, starting with, I believe, November of 2001, we had a number of scholars that I'm going to call them supply-side authors. And the first paper that came out running was Kruger and Malakova. They found that militants are, in fact, they're looking at suicide terrorists. They found, you know, these guys are more educated than the societal mean from which they're drawn. And then there was a chorus of other supply-side scholars. I mean, Mark Sageman, you all know him. Peter Bergen, you know, he also did an assessment of international terrorists and the connections to madrasas, Claude Barabi, Ethan Bueno de Mesquita, even I did a survey of, commissioned a survey of militants in Pakistan. And resoundingly, we're not seeing a connection between madrasas and militants. They just aren't showing up. Most of the studies I told you about, Claude Barabi, Mark Sageman, Kruger Malakova, these are really the high-end terrorists. These are people who are suicide terrorists. You know, if you look at suicide terrorism, there's an opportunity cost of screwing up a suicide attack. So people tend to send their better operatives out on suicide missions. So I would expect to see higher-end people appearing in a data set of suicide terrorists. But even in my study in Pakistan, where we have a mix of high-end and low-end, we're still not seeing a lot of madrasa students. Out of 141 families that bothered to be surveyed, only 19 said that their sons were recruited at madrasas, and only 33 attended a madrasa, most of whom also attended a public school. Take-home message from my survey is these are not substitute goods. I mean, you can actually do these things simultaneously. And the groups, the folks that are in my survey, they also attended Pakistan's mainstream schools as well. So the conclusions of what I'm going to call these supply-side studies is that actual militants are not, in general, undereducated. And if you look at the other things they say, they're not even likely to be poor relative to the societies from which they recruit. Now, this very much conflicts with this other scholarly narrative. But leaving aside Jessica Stern and ICG, you know, there's been a lot of folks at the World Bank, like Collier and Hoeffler, who, in fact, do find evidence that when there's economic repression, lack of educational opportunities, that conflict provides conflict entrepreneurs opportunities to make a living, to attain status in a way that outside of a conflict, those individuals don't have those opportunities. So how do we square this circle? We've got pretty solid folks who say, yes, poor, uneducated madrasa students want to be terrorists. And yet we have this literature that says, no, hey folks, they really aren't terrorists. Well, I actually don't think there's a mystery here. The problem with the supply side analysts is that there are different layers of selection. And we all forget this. And some of these guys are labor economists, and they shouldn't be given the excuse for not keeping this in mind, because I've seen their stuff elsewhere, and they understand selection bias. But they skated by on this one. So let me give you an example. Let's think about an average college class that graduates. We look at the characteristics of these folks, their GPA, maybe their performance on the SAT or the GRE. No one would say that the characteristics of these graduates from college really resemble in any way the number of people who applied to that college. Well, what's the reason for that? Well, there's selection bias. Who chose to apply? Then you have this entire selection board that says you're good enough to come to our school, and then there's yet another. All these folks who then decide, here are my options, what am I going to do? Now, if you look at the work of Ethan Bueno de Mesquita, and he wrote a fantastic paper, you all should read it, called The Quality of Terror. He kind of brought what people who study terrorism have known for a long time. They don't just take anyone that shows up at their door. They also apply the standards of quality. So I want to go back to the case of Pakistan's madrasas. It may be the case that madrasa students, all else equal, compared to their counterparts in public and private schools. They may want to be terrorists more than anyone else. We don't know that because we don't interview those people. We don't see those people. We have no scientifically rigorous way of ascertaining whether, in fact, they more than anyone else of their cohort at other schools want to be terrorists. So let's just pretend that they are. As long as there are more qualified people who want to be terrorists than there are actually slots for terrorists, they have other options. And I think this may be one way of squaring the circle. It may be the case that madrasas produce people who, all else equal, want to be terrorists more than anyone else. But as long as these groups have other options available, for example, unemployed college graduates, they don't have to take them. And what I'm trying to get at, is it madrasas that make terrorists or not? That's actually the wrong question. Going back to Paul's point, we have to think about the right data and we have to think about the right questions. I tend to think of this as a labor market supply model. When I was at RAND, I did a lot of work on military manpower and recruiting. We have to think about what are the operational requirements of where these guys are serving. So in my part of the world, I look at Kashmir. If I'm a militant commander, I'm not going to send a bozo to Kashmir. Why is that? I have to cross the line of control. About 14,000, 15,000 feet, it's hard to do that. It's a rigorous terrain. These folks are from the Punjab. They don't speak Kashmiri. Being able to sustain a cover is very difficult for folks who don't have some modicum of quality. I've seen their manuals. These folks write in English. They know how to make a bomb using stuff they can get in the market. They do fractions. I've been to madrasas. They don't do fractions at madrasas. And if you go, if you're a terrorist who has to hang out in Delhi for any time period, your operational requirements are even more demanding. So what I'm saying is, to figure out where these guys come from, we have to look at their operational environment and what kind of human capital endowments are required to operate there. Conversely, if you're a Pakistani militant, it's really easy to get into Afghanistan. You speak Pashto, there's no LOC, there really isn't even any sort of border control for the most part, except at some designated checkpoints, which you can easily work your way around. So I would expect there to be madrasa students operating in Afghanistan, and sure enough, you know, I think we're seeing that. So what I'm trying to say to you is not that Jessica Stern was wrong and the World Bank was right, but the question is wrong. We have to look at madrasas for the reasons why they might matter. Now, right now, we're not seeing madrasas matter, and I'm going to argue because of this quality issue. So what happens if the economic situation in Pakistan changes, where somehow engineers in Pakistan suddenly get employed and they're no longer available for Jamaat-ul-Dawah or Lashkar-e-Taiba or Jaish-e-Wakadoon? It may be that these groups no longer have the high-end recruits at their disposal, and they may then have to start reaching into the madrasa population for their recruits. Let me give you an example. For those of you who are interested or knowledgeable of how the Army recruits, when we don't meet our quality standards and we can't make the numbers, what do? We march it down. My brother's an Army recruiter, drives him crazy. But let me go back to two other reasons why we ought to be concerned about madrasas. Now, I want to keep, let's keep the big picture. 70% of students are educated in Pakistan's public schools. 30% are educated in private schools. Most people don't know that. Madrasa students are smaller than the rounding error in the sum of those two main fractions. So I want to, let's keep the big picture in mind. But there are two other reasons why we ought to be concerned about madrasas, apart from the fact that the entire question has been framed inappropriately. The first, okay, let's say that right now, under the current recruiting environment for militant organizations in Pakistan, they don't need madrasas. But there is evidence that madrasas do contribute to a culture that supports militancy and jihad. Where am I getting these data from? Well, it turns out Tariq Rahman did a very interesting survey, about little under 500 students, also interviewed their teachers, public, private, as well as madrasas. And he has some opinions about their support for jihad in India, their support for militant groups, support for outright war. He asked about their support for minority rights, women rights, Ahmadiyyas, and Hindus, and so forth. Sure enough, those madrasa students look pretty darn scary. They are not people I would want to have my niece fraternizing with. They are more likely to support war than any of the other two groups. They definitely are more likely to support, and the numbers are, I mean, we're talking not, you know, minor difference, we're talking majority of these students support jihad, support militancy, all-out war with India. They are universal in their demand that minorities and women should not be treated equally. Now, as horribly frightening as the students are, their teachers are even more, narrow-minded and more likely to support violent options. But let's just pretend that I couldn't see the column of the data for the madrasa students. Let's just pretend that I can't see it. And I just looked at those public school students who comprise 70% of Pakistan's education market. Those folks are also not people I'd want my niece hanging out with. It may be that they're less likely than madrasa students, but they're a heck of a lot more likely than private students to support non-peaceful outcomes. Now, I want to say right up front, while he interviewed the teachers, he didn't interview the parents. So I don't want to prematurely say, oh, gee, the policy option is move all those madrasa students, all 1% of them, into the private school. It may be that parents that are, you know, less peaceful, less open-minded, choose madrasas for that reason. So we have an endogeneity problem. But there are a lot of other data that do suggest that's not why parents suggest or choose madrasas. And we can talk about that in the Q&A. The data that I've seen suggests that parents who choose private schools are doing so for ideological reasons, but not madrasas. And just a quick fact before I leave this topic. Of all households that use madrasas to educate at least one child, only 25% of them use madrasas for all children. So the majority of households that use a madrasa also use a public and or a private school to educate the rest of their kids. So if you are, you know, a closed-minded, non-peaceful fanatic, why are you sending at least one kid to a madrasa, another kid to a public or private school? That doesn't make any sense. So we can talk more about these different kinds of data and how they conflict with the popular narrative. But I want to make one final point before shutting up. I've got two more minutes, right? The other reason for concern is sectarian violence. What I didn't talk about, but I've got a big book that talks about it if it makes it through review, madrasas are inherently, they're a sectarian business. What do madrasas do for a living? They make ulama. What do ulama do? Ulama defend the worldview of their sect, not just Shia Sunni, but several different kinds of sectarian differences within the Sunni tradition against each other. In other words, why is my worldview superior to yours, and why is it that you should agree with me? This is what ulama do in Pakistan. They probably do it elsewhere. I don't know. They do it in India. They do it in Bangladesh. So the job of a madrasa is to produce people that espouse and propound in a convincing way. They call it, when I talk to the people in madrasas, comparative religion. Other people call it sectarian hatred. So we do have this problem with madrasas that they produce people with these worldviews. And in Pakistan, for those of you who know, Mr. Musharraf, you know, made quite a bit of stink about this. Pakistan is a victim of terrorism. I mean, we can talk about the reasons called blowback and negative externalities and other such things. But hundreds of people die every year from sectarian violence. So this is a huge problem for Pakistan. And so when Pakistanis talk about madrasa reform, do they mean it? Yes, they do, because they're sick and tired of people dying in sectarian violence. In fact, there was a final point before shutting up completely. Salim Ali, a scholar under USIP, he got a grant from USIP. He actually did some very interesting graphical imaging. And he did find, although one can quibble with the statistical soundness of his selection, he did find that where you have a concentration of madrasas, you have a higher propensity for sectarian violence. So the point is, with madrasas, it's not the question, do they or do they not make militants? The question is, we have to look at the operational requirements for the mission. And going back to the sectarian issue, for all of you who look at sectarian violence, at least in Pakistan, this is a low-end attack. You've got some guy going into church throwing a grenade. This does not require fractions. So, you know, the sectarian problem very much fits within the overall schism, you know, the overall scheme that I'm laying out, which is it's not a binary. It's, you have to look at the operation and look at the human capital that's required to conduct that operation to figure out where these guys are coming from.
Thank you, Christine. Very interesting presentation. I'd like people from the audience, if you'd like to ask questions, please come up to the mic. Very welcome.
We've stunned them into silence.
And while people are coming up, I'd like to ask a question myself. The most recent national intelligence estimate, which was leaked and then partially released, assessed that the war in Iraq is exacerbating jihadist recruitment rather than the result that we have heard from the administration. And I wonder if Paul could look at that from the prism of the model in shaping the environment.
Okay. Thanks, Ted. Let me just, before I answer your specific question about the NAIE, let me say something more broadly relevant to it. And in all the discussion about the NIE, what I think was missed was that this was, I think, the first effort since 9/11 to actually try to to do some kind of broad assessment of our performance in the so-called war on terror. We haven't obviously seen the classified documents, so we are unsure how they actually, the actual performance measures or metrics that were used. But some of you will recall several years ago, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, lamented about the fact that we don't have metrics to assess whether we are killing or capturing more people than the madrasas and mosques and radical imams are actually recruiting. And we still don't have an answer to that. I find it extraordinary that, you know, we're 5 years after 9/11 and there has been so little systematic effort to try to assess how well we're doing. Is this challenge that we're facing growing, diminishing, moving into new areas, changing character? We don't have a very good way, certainly a systematic way of assessing that. And you know, we're trying to address that here at the Institute in some efforts to try to look at individual regions in a systematic fashion using other indicators beyond the purely kill and capture metrics which we tend to rely on to try to get an answer to these broad questions. And I find it extraordinary that there still is no regular assessment of this challenge and to try to figure out whether it's growing, changing character, moving into new areas in a rigorous fashion. And Christine was, I think, the underlying message in her talk was that the use of rigorous research and analysis of this problem has been pathetic, really pathetic. And even though, you know, we're 5 years into this, we still don't have a good handle on it. And so we can only go on some of what's been released publicly about the NIE. I think it's from what we understand about how the war in Iraq has been used by jihadist websites and other recruitment efforts in the Muslim world, I think that there is clear evidence that yes, the NIE the Iraq war has been a central sort of recruiting tool for the jihadists. And in terms of how it fits into my broad model, it is one of those key environmental factors that provides credence to the central tenets of the jihadist narrative that Islam is under attack from the West and requiring a defensive jihad in response. And it provides, I think, a lot of support to that view in terms of how it's gone. So I agree with the NIE. I just wish that there were kind of non-classified NIEs being undertaken by research groups around town to get a better sense of how we're doing and to really improve the level of our empirical understanding of this phenomena, rather than us having to rely on leaked portions and then partial portions of a classified national assessment.
Could I add something to that point, Paul? I mean, I ditto that frustration. Of course, Paul's my boss, and so I have to. But no, the thing is, since 9/11, what I find so remarkable is the resistance to accept and use and understand data. And it is paralyzing. From the get-go, we had folks at Gallup, we had folks at Zogby, the most recent Gallup poll, Pew. There have been analyses that show, without a question of statistical doubt, with margins of confidence that, you know, they're ridiculously confident, that show consistently that one of the best predictors of support for terrorism is this notion of threat. Ethan Bueno de Mosquito, we hired him to refine an analysis I did with Brian Shepard using the Pew data. And again, I mean, it's this threat perception. The biggest predictor of whether or not someone says they're going to support terrorism and with that intensity is the intensity with which they believe the U.S. is a threat to Islam. And there, you know, if you look at the most recent poll that the Gallup folks did, they had a different way of slicing up extremists, but it was very similar. It was, do you support or did you find morally justifiable the 9/11 attacks? And the people that said yes to that question, well, guess what? They were also people who thought that U.S. was a threat to Islam. So there's a growing body of literature that folks just don't seem to pay attention to.
Okay.
Madam, if you could tell us your name and where you're from.
I'm Santanina Rasul from the Philippines, southern Philippines, actually. I was intrigued by the presentation of Dr. Stairs when he compared Islamist militancy to a disease, an epidemic, and he came out with a strategy on how to counter, and he enumerated three strategies to counter Islamist militancy. But I wonder why he didn't mention addressing the root cause of that Islamist militancy. And then I would like to relate that to the earlier presentation of Dr. Magrawi when he enumerated the causes for anti-Americanism all over the world. And he mentioned the three, but he didn't mention the perception of the Muslims of American support for Israel. So these are two related issues in my mind.
Let me address the first one, and maybe Abdeslam might want to say something. I probably didn't explain myself that clearly. I was rushing to get through a lot of complex information, but this model does capture the so-called root causes in the third element, the remedy, the environmental factors that help lead to the rise and spread of Islamist militancy. And so the three elements, what we call the CPR strategy, contain, protect, remedy. The remedy is really addressing the root causes. It's another way of describing those factors that we think are key in driving this phenomenon. So we do look at it. I just didn't get into a great deal of detail, but it's the broad array of social, political, economic factors that that are clearly relevant here.
Sorry, very quick. When I mentioned that after World War II, the America's image was positive in the Muslim world, I implicitly meant that the change in perceptions of, not playing a fair role in the Middle East or in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was a problem.
Thank you. My name is Peter Gubser. I'm running an NGO that works in the Middle East, American Near East Refugee Aid. Coming from that sort of seat, we approach the Middle East, Muslim world, more from an economic and social development perspective. I'd like to ask Paul Stairs how you factor in economic and social development type of issues in your model. Specifically, say on the economic area, adjusting the economic and financial rules so it opens up the economic system much more to the ordinary person rather than being just under the hands of the oligarchs, and such things as improving education, revolutionizing education so people are better able to work in their own countries, in the region, and in the world.
Thank you. That's a very good question. It's probably the one area that we've done the least work on, even though we recognize it to be one of the most important. And it's purely my own sort of academic intellectual biases, not being an economist, in actually filling out some more details in that area. To the extent that we've focused on it, we've drawn from the Arab Development Reports, the 2-3 now, I think, that pointed to the serious structural deficiencies of the Arab world in particular in terms of economic performance. The numbers are just staggering. I'm wary of my memory to get them right, but it's something like all Arab states don't have the GDP of Spain or something. It's just extraordinary if you add them all up. And what I'm particularly concerned about is the demographic, certainly the youth bulge that is about to, I hate to use this term, explode in key areas in the Arab world. I think if you look at the expected rise of the population of Yemen in the coming years, it's phenomenal. It's going to be almost the size of current Egypt. Other key areas, other key countries, some of the Gulf states, and certainly Saudi Arabia, there's going to be a terrific demographic boom in the next 10 years. And of course, the key question is, where are these folks going to find jobs? And the expectations are that they're just not going to be the jobs there for these people to have. And so when you're talking in tens of millions of people that could be potentially unemployed and alienated and disaffected, this is a very potent situation for potential jihadist recruiters and so on to exploit. And so I'm particularly concerned about that. I can't give you a detailed prescription, an economic prescription of what one does about that, other than going, frankly, not much further than the standard bromides about improving trade and investment in this area and opening the area up for broader integration into a globalizing economy through telecommunications and basic economic education that is appropriate for the modern world. These, I think, are all basic prescriptions that the Arab Development Report had pointed to, and I think are important. I would like to see someone be a little more specific and say, well, what are the key areas that we could really get the most bang for the buck, again, to use a horrible metaphor, in terms of economic development of these areas, to soak up some of the youth bulge that's coming, to really provide some economic hope in these societies when there's so little. And that is really key. And I would like to see more work done on that. I think it's the missing dimension, if you will, of the so-called war on terror. But a great question. Thank you.
Hi, Oliver Wilcox from USAID. And my first question is for Dr. Stairs. It's a very interesting sort of conceptual model you lay out for thinking about the problem and how to respond to it. But two sort of more specific questions and probably challenges that you've been thinking about or grappling with in terms of this model. One is context, because of course context matters, and if you break the Muslim world down not just into regions but obviously into countries. And so have you given thought to sort of piloting this model in terms of picking one or two countries as case studies? And if you have done that, can you give us kind of the thumbnail sketch of how it would work in a Lebanon or a Yemen or a Pakistan or an Indonesia or wherever you might have done that thinking? The other question is for Dr. Fair. Can you give us a more comparative sense of madrasas or their sort of analogs in other countries? A lot of the attention, of course, is focused on Pakistan, and yet madrasas or their analogs are sort of a Muslim worldwide. In the Arab world, they're known as kutabs, Quranic schools, and you find them, of course, in parts of West Africa, too. So can you give us a sense of how Pakistan compares with, or how the rest of the Muslim world compares with madrasas in Pakistan, and is Pakistan more of an exception? How does it reflect the other countries? Thanks.
Let me address the first question. It's a terrific question also. We have not gone, frankly, beyond the more general prescription to specific country-focused strategies, game plans. I think it's something that needs to be done. We recognize that the broad framework that we propose is not a one-size-fits-all prescription. And just as global health officials mix and match different initiatives for specific countries that take into account the cultural background, the economic development, the infrastructure, political systems, so any tailored counter-epidemic approach to any specific country should also reflect that. But I think just as this broad model, we call it the epidemiologic triad of the agent, host, environment, and the vectors, can be adjusted to any given situation, and you can put different weightings on it. So that can be tailored, that framework can be tailored to any specific country, for that matter, any particular city or region. you know, that's what we think is the beauty of this. This is a very adaptable approach that allows you to capture all the elements and provide this integrated game plan. And just as WHO, when they put together a global health plan for specific countries, they have this framework, they put different aspects on it, and we can do the same for specific countries. And I think it's a very easily understandable framework, and one that allows you, again, to integrate different elements, not privilege one aspect, not privilege the military side necessarily. And I can get into more specific things that one might do, but I think clearly the next stage in the work that we're doing is to possibly pick one or two countries, you know, the Yemen or Lebanon, as you said, and try to deconstruct it, looking at the problem in that particular, and then try to pull it, bring it all back together into a coherent game plan or strategy for dealing with it. But that would be the ideal thing that we'd like to do.
Actually, I didn't get into this because of the draconian time limits that we're going to be enforced by having our hands cut off. But in Pakistan, fingertips, brutal beating. In Pakistan, I want to say Madaras are not the same as Qutb. In Pakistan, Qutb, my understanding, and I'm a South Asianist, so my knowledge stops where Afghanistan ends and Iran begins. But Qutbs are mosque schools. And my understanding, and we have those also in Pakistan, but they're called maktabs. It's from the same root in Arabic. Mosque schools in Pakistan, you very rarely do anything more than nazara, which is learning to recite the Quran. Maybe in a more sophisticated one, you might do hifz-e Quran, where you study and memorize the Quran, become a hafiz. In Pakistan, unfortunately, as you know, the word madaras also just means school, so which is why Pakistanis often say dini madaras. And the sine qua non of a madaras is the use of a curriculum called Dars-e-Nizami, or the Alim course. It's a four-stage course. The four different certificates are granted all along, called sanads. And it's the sort of capstone course is, of course, to become an alim, to become an ulama. And some madaras actually have sort of postgraduate studies in jurisprudence or what have you. Those are more competent madaras that actually have the faculty that are capable of doing these postgraduate studies. So, and this is true of all of South Asia. If you look at madrasa reform, it really came out of Deoband trying to make Muslims relevant to participate in the machinery of the British Raj. So they consolidated this curriculum. They put in certain things that they thought would make them better court advisors, better lawyers, better judges, and so forth. I do want to make one point. In the same way that the Madaras curriculum has not evolved, and if you look at the texts that are used, I think that the most recent text is 300 years old. In the same way that that curriculum hasn't evolved, throughout all of South Asia, you're still using Macaulay's curriculum for the public school. So this is an entire problem of a decrepit, defunct educational system that's failed to respond to the modernization of these countries and the needs of a modern economy. In Bangladesh, again, there are five schools under which most madrasas are organized. They tend to use a very similar curriculum. But in Bangladesh, I think we do see a stronger connection between madrasas and militancy. And the reason for that is, in Pakistan, to say it, they're not state actors. They, for the most part, enjoy state support. I mean, we're not supposed to say that because Musharraf is our friend, the global war on terrorism, but the fact remains the ISI has propped these guys up. They continue to do so. In Bangladesh, that's not so clear. So, you have to go back to, again, the operational environment in which militancy demands people, how they get them, how they mission them, the kind of state support they enjoy or they don't support. So I think in Bangladesh, when it's all said and done, although collecting data in Bangladesh is near impossible, we may see a stronger connection. In India, we don't see a strong connection. Kashmir, the so-called nuclear flashpoint of the world, no significant militant of any consequence ever came from a madrasa in Kashmir, despite the fact that Kashmir is the site of rapid growth of madrasas, anomaly. In fact, if you look in India and in Bangladesh, where you see the biggest connection between education and militancy is with the student wings of Jamaat Islami at university. So we're talking about Chhatra Shabir in Bangladesh, and India we're talking about Simi. So I can only talk about the regional dimension. Trained Afghanistan, most of their, because of the fact that for 30 years it's been a war-torn society, most of the students went to lower-level secondary primary school madrasas, and they went to Pakistan to complete their alim courses. So that's that's about the limits of the comparison that I can give you. Does that suffice?
My name is Stephen Bosco. I'm a junior officer in the U.S. Navy. Both of you mentioned that a perceived threat to Islam is a main recruiting tool for the militant Islamists. My question is there any way that we can engage in the kind of military operations that we need to contain the threat without then providing additional recruiting tools for the Islamists, especially given that the conflict in Afghanistan, which I think is less controversial in the West, is also a major recruiting tool for the Islamists. Thanks.
Shall I take it? It's a terrible dilemma. It's, you know, how do we carry out military operations that we feel are important for our own national security to degrade, destroy threats to U.S. national security without providing the very arguments or providing ammunition to the arguments of the jihadists that Islam is under attack from the West. And it's, you know, there's a basic contradiction here, and how do we do this? And I think the key is to provide this countervision, this ideological countervision, an explanation of why we're doing this in a more effective manner than we have before. And it has two components. It's one, delegitimizing the jihadist message and narrative and explaining why this is not hopeful for the average Muslim person and why it's leading the Muslim world in the wrong direction. And it also requires providing them with a positive vision for the future. And Abdeslam Maghrawi has been working on the concept of Islamic renewal and revival to provide that more positive without trying to address the ideological component while conducting military operations is just fueling the flames. So that too have to be done. You cannot just conduct military operations and leave the ideological battleground to the jihadists to exploit. And so that is absolutely critical that the two be done hand in glove. In terms of how do we undermine the jihadist narrative? Again, I'm intrigued by some of the lessons from, believe it or not, immunization and vaccination. If you look at the basic physical principles of vaccination, is that you expose the population, particularly the most susceptibles, to a weakened or attenuated form of the virus, so that when they're exposed to the real thing, the body learns to reject it. That's how vaccines work. And so can we use the same basic principles in ideological terms to fight the jihadist message? And here I look at negative campaigning in U.S. elections as instructive in this fashion. And to take the Bush-Kerry campaign, the Bush campaign, I think, deliberately exposed swing voters to the notion that Senator Kerry was a flip-flopper. They didn't offer their alternative vision. They basically exposed the swing voters to the notion that Kerry was a waffler, changed his mind, and couldn't be trusted or didn't really have the backbone to stay the course, et cetera, et cetera. So that when that population was exposed to the real Kerry making this case, they had already been primed to essentially reject it. And so there was no alternative vision being offered. You know, the Republicans clearly did have that, but it provided the way to undermine the Democratic campaign. And I think those general tactics, if you will, that general approach, can be used in undermining the jihadist message. It's tough when there are these other images that people are confronted with, but I think exposing them to, what is Bin Laden saying? Why is this not in your interests? pointing to all kinds of inconsistencies and schisms within jihadist ideology. We just don't do that. It's not a black art. You know, there are aspects of it that might be, done in a covert fashion. But we have singularly failed to do that in any systematic fashion. And if we just use half of the skills we apply to presidential campaigning in this country to doing that, you know, we're so keen on trying to develop, you know, Madison Avenue techniques for selling ourselves, we're not thinking about the methods that we use in presidential campaigns to undermine your opponent. And I think we should use those same techniques in dealing with the jihadist message. Now, you know, 5 years later, a lot of damage has been done and we face an uphill battle, but I still think we can do certain things to do that. But to me, that's the, you know, when you conduct the military operations as we inevitably probably will have to, then you have to have the ideological campaign, the political warfare, if you will, the propaganda aspects, and they have to be given as much attention, as much priority as your military planning.
Can I chime in here? I'm going to take a stricter answer to this, or a stricter approach. I mean, at some point, history is going to have to ask, were the costs and benefits of the Iraq War worth it? I mean, how does that balance sheet work out? And I'm going to just give you my views from South Asia. I was struck that after operations in Afghanistan, which actually generally most folks didn't actually have a positive view towards the Taliban, you really didn't see enormous protests. I mean, you had a few, and they were well publicized on CNN. I'm convinced they just replicated the images to make the crowd look bigger. Not to mention, many of them were actually coordinated protests. I mean, the Jamaat Islami and JUI actually bussed people to the scene of filming. But we didn't really see the kind of mobilization of anger and outrage after OEF that we did after Operation Iraqi Freedom. And let's take the Indian Muslims, for example. I really like this example. You know, for so long, we kind of took for granted that the Indian Muslim, you know, they're not popping up in Guantanamo, they're not popping up in Al-Qaeda, and everyone had all kinds of reasons for it. I think those reasons were probably wrong. But the one thing, I mean, for example, Muslims in India do commit terrorism. You can't both have the Kashmir insurgency going on since the late 70s and say Indian Muslims don't do terrorism, because clearly they do. Certainly after Gujarat, the revelation has really hit home that Indian Muslims have really become part of global Islam in a way that they probably weren't after Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. Iraq, in a way that was very different from Afghanistan, has mobilized certain Muslim publics in ways that had been unprecedented. Now, India is going to have to grapple with this. Why is it that Indian Muslims are now being recruited by Lashkar-e-Taiba to commit operations as atrocious as they were in Mumbai? Now, this is a genie that's been let out of the bottle. But at some point, there needs to be some reckoning of costs and benefits. And the NIE, I think, is taking a step in that direction. But let's take a look again at Afghanistan. It's a question of priority, and it's about resources, and it's about, are we doing what we say we do? So if you talk to folks who study Afghanistan, they find it really curious, the constitutional structure. It meets our requirements, but doesn't meet Afghan requirements. Or if you take a look at what Pakistanis say about what we say and what we do, and I'm going to be really explicit about this. I don't care whether you talk to a rickshawwala or a very high-end newspaper editor. Pakistanis are pissed that we support Musharraf. They don't understand how we say we support democracy, that we prop up a military dictator. And this is a fundamental problem in Pakistan. You ask why they hate us? Well, this is one really important reason. It's not just what we do in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's a perceived, they don't believe what we say we do. Like, you invade Iraq for democracy? How can that be? Musharraf, he's your best friend here. And I was in Pakistan during the Khartoum riots. And at that point, President Bush was on his way. And he had just given a really important talk to the Asia Society. And I'm not joking. Even the rickshawwalas picked this up. The guys who drive the little three-wheel scooters that do all the pollution. They said to me, when President Bush talks about India, he talks about Indians. He talks about their civilization, their culture, their this, their democracies, their that, their judicial system. When he talks about Pakistan, he talks about Musharraf. And this was consistent, clearly across the board. So I'm gonna be really blunt. It's not what we do. It's how we do it. And people, it's not what we say about the policy, it's actually the policy. Let's be very clear. Every survey I've seen demonstrates demonstrable disaffection with our Israel policy. Now, the fact that our new policy is to support a viable Palestinian state doesn't seem to get any play. So I'm not diminishing the space for public policy, because very clearly we need to say better what we're doing and why we're doing it. But you know, when a rickshaw guy can ask, why do you support democracy yet you're propping up Musharraf? And I could go on about this. There are very colorful expressions that Pakistanis have to explain this peculiar behavior. But this behavior matters.
Let me just make a quick point, and then we'll have the last question, and then we'll move directly to the next panel. Now, a thought, remember, if you're going to address the issue of Muslims feel under threat, and that, from the perspective of the United States, is something that you want to address in terms of shaping the environment. Christine talked a bit about the impact of our Iraq policy on shaping the environment, but in a negative way. She also talked about Middle East policy. If the United States wants to shape an environment in which Muslims do not feel under threat, then the obvious policy prescription is an effort to engage Israelis and Palestinians in negotiations once again, to demonstrate that Muslims may not be under threat. There may be areas of the world in which we can shape the environment, like Chechnya. It may be a sore in the Muslim world that the United States can deal with. But there are probably parts of it which we can, and the policy prescription there is to try to influence what we can in terms of the resources that we do have. Now, I'd like to ask people who'd like to ask questions, just to everyone ask their question, have our speakers respond, and then we'll move to the next panel.
Hi, my name is Ivan Weinstein. I'm with the State Department. In keeping with your effort to sort of take a look at the big picture, I'm wondering about your thoughts on the relationship between the high profile that's given to terrorism and the so-called war on terrorism relative to how big is the threat really. If you look at the Cold War, we were under some kind of existential threat, or at least we thought we were. If you look at World War II, there was a very real threat coming from Germany and Japan. And my question is, how proportional is the rhetoric and the response to the threat, to the actual threat itself? And I know we're short on time, but I'm also curious to hear your thoughts about how the response, we're not talking about Iraq, because obviously we've poured in a lot of resources there, but maybe more in terms of homeland security or other aspects of protecting the nation, how much what we've actually done squares with the rhetoric that we talk about what the priority is.
Okay, one question, please.
Hi, I'm Tyler Rauert from the Near East South Asia Center at NDU. I had one question when I came up here, but Dr. Stairs, your discussion of delegitimizing the sort of jihadist message spurred another one to me. When you talk about using some of our tools at negative campaigning to try to delegitimize this message, does that not look like an attack on Islam? And if that's the case, then isn't that simply compounding the problem that we all acknowledge we already face? Thanks.
Thank you.
Samira Daniels. Related to this question, this issue of using these kinds of tactics have been discussed for the last 30 years or in that part of the world, and I think that I just wonder what is the net effect. I mean, if you look at the commentary about our campaign process and what it yields, you realize that people become even more hardened to their position, and the net result has been such a high degree of uncivility and partisanship that we can't even we've sort of crippled ourselves. So I'd just like you to be a little bit more specific.
Thank you. And very quickly, sir, please.
Blair King with the National Democratic Institute. My question is for Christine. I'm still uncertain about the policy implications of your analysis of the Pakistani educational system. It seems like there's at least two things or two elements going on here. On the one hand, you've got sort of the students and teachers' overall worldview that you described as being quite conservative in the madrasa population, but even, you know, only slightly less conservative or militant in the public school population.
you've also got the curricula, which you also describe as being decrepit and stagnant and that sort of thing. But if you accept my assumption that if you have the political will to do so, it's easier to reform the curriculum than it is to change people's worldviews in a relatively rapid period of time. If the policy prescription is to reform the curriculum, don't you then end up with simply better educated militants and therefore a larger pool of potential militants who now know fractions and other things, and makes the problem simply worse. So if that's, you clearly agree with that, then what is the policy implications of your analysis?
Thank you. Okay, Paul.
Okay. Let me run quickly through these questions. I really can't do them justice in the time we have left. Firstly, the comparison of the war on terror with previous generational challenges. I think for those who fought in the Second World War and have lived through the Cold War, I think their views would be that this isn't comparable in terms of the magnitude of the threat, in terms of what Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany posed to the United States and civilization in general. Cold War, the Soviet Union clearly posed an existential threat to the United States in terms of what it could do with nuclear weapons. I don't think the threat posed by Islamist militancy is similar, or rather is comparable in terms of the magnitude of the threat, certainly the nature of the threat. But it is serious, and it should not be underestimated. And the conjunction of Islamist militancy with the potential for the use of weapons of mass destruction, which we all know many of them are ruminated about, and there's a lot of evidence that they've sought that, is extremely worrisome, and therefore should be taken into, given the level of priority and concern that it deserves. But I don't think in terms of the magnitude of the threat that it's comparable to these earlier generational challenges. That's not to say it couldn't become one. The delegitimization issue is very important. That two things. One is this is something that shouldn't really be done, or certainly led by the United States and the West. This process has to be done from within the Muslim world by responsible spokespeople from key leaders, clerics, from media officials, sports stars, media stars. It should be a broad effort coming from within the Muslim world. Otherwise, it doesn't have the legitimacy that it needs. And it certainly could feed the concern that you have about this just being seen as another threat or another attack on Islam. It should also be carried out in conjunction, and I tried to make this point earlier, with the provision of a positive image or positive vision for the Muslim world. It cannot just be about tearing down the jihadist ideology, and I never thought I would be a proponent of negative campaigning, but negative campaigning is only good for certain things. It doesn't provide a really good platform to be attractive to most people over the long term. So it has to, any efforts to delegitimize the jihadist ideology has to be balanced with the provision of a moderate, positive vision for the future, which again has to come from within the Muslim world. It can't be the US. We can do certain things to help that, but these voices have to come from within the Muslim world. I think that addresses the question.
And Christine will
close. All right, I'm going to try to be brief, but it took me 135 pages to make this argument. So school reform, I argue, needs a theory of parental choice. This is nothing new. When we do school reform here, we intuitively understand that this is about parents making decisions for their children. What underlies parental choice? Parents make, the first decision they make in Pakistan and elsewhere is, do I educate my kid? Now, in Pakistan, a lot of people say, hell no, I'm not educating my kid. Why? Because the costs, which are comprised not only of school books, uniforms, but also distance. And if you have a girl who lives far away from a school, she's not going to go to school. There are a lot of cultural issues. So cost is not just money. It's about, is my daughter at risk to being Eve teased, a term I hate, but nonetheless they use, if she goes to school. So cost is a different kind of set of bundles. There's also opportunity costs. When I send my son or my daughter to school, I'm forgoing lost wages if they clean shoes on the street, agricultural production, domestic production. So costs writ large have to exceed the benefits. Now, what do I mean by benefits? Benefits are numerous kinds. They include returns to the labor market. By the way, a madrasa-educated girl gets better grooms. It's like, you know, a convent-educated bride. So the returns to education include economic opportunities in the labor force, and in terms social opportunities. And so parents are making fundamental decisions. Do the costs outweigh the benefits? So going back to your question about better educated students not getting jobs becoming available, yeah, in the short term, it's entirely possible that improving education, provided that you can, by the way, I don't think you can, I don't think the political will is there. Too many people benefit from the status quo, but let's just pretend in Fantasyland and Disney World, we reform that educational system. Yeah, there's a possibility you're going to have better educated terrorists. So this tells me what? We need to have job creation, and we need to transform Pakistan's economy. And herein lies the big bugaboo. If you actually look at all the jobs available in Pakistan, they come from the army, they come from the bureaucratic services, you know, the civil service. The biggest chunk of jobs actually come from the agricultural sector and also from small business people who own shops. Oh, by the way, not a lot of bang to your buck. And I think that's probably why the average number of years attained in Pakistan for males is 6 years, and for girls it's even fewer, it's like three. So very quickly, in an economy like that, you have diminishing margins of return to education. Parents, you know, they don't need to be an economist to figure this out. So if you want to change the school system and you want to change the matrix that links education to militancy, you have to think hard about parental choice. By the way, parents who are sending their kids to madrasas, they're not the only ones. There's a whole new class of schools that have cropped up in Pakistan to accommodate the fact that parents of the most elite variety want their kids to have an Islamic education. And very expensive schools are combining Islamic as well as so-called secular education. So this is not just about political will. It's about having a thorough net assessment of understanding what drives education reform. If you look at the U.S. in the 70s and 80s, we had a huge explosion of post-secondary education. People were asking why. Well, it's very simple. If you look at the return to a college education in the labor market, it was huge, and people went into debt because there was a payoff to that. Again, I tell my folks working in the government, there's a huge literature on parental choice, not only in the United States, which is entirely applicable, but the World Bank's done so much stuff on this in Pakistan, but folks just don't seem to know it, and they don't seem to use it. I want to make one final point. We can talk about this, you know, if you want via email, because I know you. You have my email address. I want to make one point. The military in their schools use the exact same crappy Macaulay curriculum, yet, for some reason, their kids get jobs. So if you look at the secondary, the sort of separate state, the military, and by military I mean the, you know, just the Army, but also the Air Force, as well as the Navy, which the Navy is the fourth of three services, but they all have a welfare state. And in Pakistan, they call it womb-to-grave welfare. So these services have their own schools in which they educate their children. They're using the same curriculum in most cases. Why is it that those kids are getting jobs? Well, it's very obvious. You know, they're educated. They're then going into that sector of the economy where there's returns to that investment. They also have access because the military owns everything. They can go to very elite schools outside of the country, and then thus you have Musharraf's son living in Boston. So there are two worlds in Pakistan. There's the world of the military and the close civil servants who kind of have a sweet life, and then there's the rest of Pakistan. So given the military has been in charge of this country for more than half of its life, why is it that their kids have a decent education but not the rest of the country? No one's asking that question. I ask why.
Thank you very much. We're going to proceed directly to the next panel. I'd just like to mention to everyone that you can see Paul's material and Christine's material on the Institute's website if you'd like to read up more on these subjects. Thank you very much.